Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by Falling Water. We think that we each dream our own dreams, right? But what if someone could use your dreams against you without you ever knowing? On October 13th, the producers of The Walking Dead and Homeland present Falling Water, a new original drama on USA Network, where the battle for your dreams is real and happens while you sleep. Starring David Ajala and William Lee, Falling Water is a new original series that airs Thursday, October 13th at 10, 9 Central, only on USA Network. Today's episode of The Watch is also brought to you by Uniqlo. Uniqlo offers the latest women's, men's, and kids' clothing and accessories. This winter, we want you to stay warm with their line of heat tech clothing. Choose heat tech for regular winter wear and heat tech extra warm for those really cold days. Undershirts, tights, socks, scarves, hats, fleeces, and even pants that fit seamlessly into your everyday life. The products are slim and not bulky. The moisture wicking fabric retains heat and also features anti-odor properties to keep you feeling fresh even when you sweat. I hate when you get hot in the cold. That's my thing. So check it out now. Go to uniqlo.com or find a Uniqlo store near you. That's uniqlo.com. Uniqlo Lifewear. Simple made better.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me in the studio, he'd love to know what IPAs you have on tap. It's Andy Greenwald!
Just like a little bit hoppy.
Yeah, do you like IPAs?
No, I think that's a ridiculous thing.
Trayvon, do you like IPAs?
No, I don't. I don't drink beer, man.
We're joined by Trayvon Free today from Any Given Wednesday from the room where it's happening.
Yes.
The Hamilton podcast. What's up, man? Trayvon's here to talk to us about Atlanta.
Can we talk with us about Atlanta? We're going to talk about Atlanta. We're going to talk about the Rogue One trailer. We might talk about the Strokes a little bit, as we promised. But we're going to start with Atlanta. And we're going to talk about this week's incredible episode of Atlanta. But first, we have to talk about why Trayvon is specifically here, is because he was kind enough to listen to our podcast about Atlanta last week.
And he had some notes.
He had some notes. And you know what? In the spirit of constructive criticism, I'd like to take those notes publicly, because I had a lot of comments about the episode, specifically in my role as television's most entitled sommelier. And you had some notes. Do you want to share those notes? This is fine.
Is it a note? It was more of like a clarification.
Yeah, just clarify it.
It's fine. It was all in good.
In trying to explore why Van and I forget her name. Jade chose the wine they chose.
And to be clear, Van didn't choose it.
Yes.
Jade.
Jade chose the wine.
Yeah.
And to me, it was very clear why, because I know black people love sweet wines. We love our Rieslings and our Moscatos.
Yes.
And so for me, it was like, oh, of course.
Of course. Andy's outraged. First of all, this is important for me to know this, and I am ashamed that I did not know this. But specifically, the show is smarter than I was giving it credit for, of course, because Van just wanted a Chardonnay. She wanted something that would pair well with her dish.
Right.
But Jade wanted the sweet wine and ordered it over the protests of Van, right?
That's
so there was a lot at play there.
Yeah.
It is.
I think it's great that this is happening, because this has been, in our country, such a time of of learning and just like an exchange of just really like frank but warmly delivered views.
But also, one thing this country's gotten really good at this year is just saying when you're wrong, you're wrong. You know? and taking a note, apologizing, and moving on. And
remember the No Hands song by Waka Flocka?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Remember the chorus? I'm a sip Moscato, and you're going to do that dance?
Yeah, that's true. We should have known that.
It
bled into hip-hop, where it was like, we got to talk about it.
I feel like I didn't appreciate that as much as I should have in the moment. I feel like maybe what we all need is, you know, like a list of what cultural products we should be enjoying during each episode.
Yes.
You know?
There should be like a food and drink guide for Atlanta each time. But you would have had a nice point the way IPA for this one.
But frankly, this is also why Atlanta, I think, is the best show on TV right now, because it is not trying to explain everything to me or to its viewers. It is assuming a wide range of knowledge from a completely specific point of view.
Right.
And you can either get on board and learn.
Right.
Learn more about Moscato. Try to pair it with the snakehead fish salad. See if it works. or not, right? And I feel like it's a better way to just try it out.
This is a good place, Zeddy, to jump in about this last episode.
Well, can we just, I wonder, before we even get into this episode, Trayvon's here to talk about Atlanta. What do you think about the show in general? Because we've been raving about it for weeks. What is your perspective on
it? I love listening to you guys talk about it. Like, every time I see the description of the watch and Atlanta's in there, I'm like, yep.
This has become like an unofficial Atlanta podcast. Usually we wouldn't do that about a 30-minute, like a comedy.
I was actually thinking today why there isn't one. Like, it totally could have its own.
I think it merits one.
Its own lane, its own podcast.
Especially because every episode, as we're now learning, is completely different.
We're open to hosting a post-Atlanta rap show on BAN.
What would the after show for Atlanta be called? Would it be called like Buckhead? Like
we call Montague.
Little 5 points. We do have a wooden table. But you're in on the show, obviously.
Oh yeah, I mean it's. I was telling Chris, it completely broke me as a writer. Just. Trying to
that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
To figure out, like, holy shit, where is the ceiling now?
Yeah.
Like, where is the line? Because I've never seen anything like this. Even knowing the show was coming for years, I did not expect this. And it's been so...
You knew the show was coming. Did you have any idea about some of, like, the formal innovations that they would be trying out, about some of the stuff that would... Just some of the tricks they'd be pulling out of that.
I had no idea. And I know someone who's very close to Donald, who's like a consultant on the show. He has a consultant credit on the show, and he never told me anything. And so even when I started seeing the ads where Donald's papering the cars and everything, it still told you nothing about the show.
Yeah.
When they're sitting on the couch watching, like, I have no idea what the show's about. And it was so smart of them to do that because you couldn't really tell anyone in one trailer exactly what people were about to experience.
We've been talking a lot over the last probably year or two, whenever a movie trailer comes out, we're talking a lot about, like, what do we need as viewers to feel safe when we're watching something? And obviously you and I are probably at the point where we're like, I don't need to feel safe. It's just like we've seen so much of it.
I just need a bottle of Moscato.
And I know the audience is, you know, generally need a little bit more signaling. I mean, it's like harder money or harder time that they're spending on these things. But part of what is so exciting about this show is that opening 35 seconds to 2 minutes, where you're just like, is this going to happen? Are they doing this? Yeah. And that's how I felt about the van episode. And that's how I felt about this one, where you're just like, as soon as it starts, you're just like, what? And then that feeling of, what?
I want to chase that for one more second, Trayvon, just as a writer too, right? Because you've been writing comedy, you've been writing on shows for a while.
Yeah.
And obviously there are templates for what you can do. There are always a sense, you know, for people in the industry of what networks are looking for, what agents are looking for, like what is the thing that might fit in, what is the peg that might fit into the hole that they're opening up in the industry for it. What does this do to your head?
It makes me feel like the traditional way of writing a show it made everything feel old.
Right.
It was like, holy shit, look what you can do with this format versus just telling a story and staying within a world that seems normal.
Yeah, yeah.
And like where boxes of chicken wings don't glow and like all those things where it's like, what? Like the last episode where the whole show is framed as a public access TV show.
Yeah.
I don't even think some people realize that the commercials were fake. I almost fast-forwarded that first Dodge commercial until I saw the TVMA logo, and I was like, oh, this is part of the show.
Yeah.
And then the way it pays off at the end is so ridiculous, but it's so funny. And I felt like, one, that's a thing. I would like to know if that was a thing that came up because the show exists on a TV network that actually has commercials. Like if HBO had Atlanta, would that have been done
big commercials? Yeah.
Right. Would they have done the fake commercials? Or would they have just done a long public access?
I just want to know is what happens that day. Because when they do like the Mickey's commercial where it's like the champagne flute and you're drinking it wrong.
Right.
That was a day on a set where they found a location where they got extras in tuxedos. And they were doing that. And on that day, the show hasn't premiered yet. They're shooting episode 7 of an experimental show for FX. Was there a moment when Donald Glover is looking at someone or he's looking at his brothers working on the show or the actors and they're just like, wait, are we really doing this?
Right.
Like, are we getting away with it? And that feeling, it had to have been maybe terrifying but then exhilarating. And that's the exhilaration that I feel as a viewer every time I watch that show.
So Justin Charity wrote a piece about this episode the night it came on. And one of the things that he talked about was the influence of the Boondocks on this episode. And I would also say that I thought with the commercials especially, it really betrayed Glover's previous work on 30 Rock. Because of that kind of like it's this manic energy mm-hmm. that gets applied, but he's applying these things, whether it's the satire of the Boondocks or the sort of screwball nature almost of 30 Rock
right.
to this different kind of like format. You know what I mean? Like, 'cause it does still have somewhere down in the like ground, it has that core story of Paperboy is trying to make it as a rapper and Earn is helping him and he's got a girlfriend who's got a kid with and all this stuff, and that stuff is still in there. He references Earn off screen. It's yeah. I just can't get over the fact that they're still hanging on to like this story like you're talking about. They're not abandoning it,
and they found a way to make it work in this crazy way.
Yeah.
Like, I always feel like I'm watching a show within a show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are moments where, like, when I'm watching that the cereal commercial, and I completely forget,
amazing.
Yeah. Right? They're like, oh yeah, this exists within the show,
yeah, right.
and somehow it makes sense.
Or that Ahmad, you know, the psychic guy, was
right.
in the premiere. I forgot that that's the yeah, same character.
Same
that's
guy.
There.
Guy.
Yeah.
yeah,
and that he's just going to keep coming back.
And then he's
or
also
not.
In. Is he? Somebody said he's like next to or walking the dog when Darius is like, this is deja
yeah,
vu.
That's yeah, him.
He's,
yeah.
That's him in the beginning.
And then he's on the bus.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Like, this is just the kind of, this is the level of thought that goes into it. And one of the things
well,
that
they didn't
I thought,
say it was going to be like Black Twin Peaks. I mean,
yeah,
that
he
was
said
like,
it was
yeah.
Twin Peaks
and the
rappers.
Phone number actually works.
Yeah.
Did you guys call the number?
Yeah. I didn't call it, but I know it works.
Yeah. yeah I mean, I was a little, I read the Vulture article about calling a phone number. It's a good use of a blog post and of my time. You call the number for me. But
that'd be great if you were like, I don't know about this, and you called it yourself even as you were reading the Vulture
yeah,
post. Like, let me double check.
Let me fact check Vulture here. The other thing about the episode that I was really struck by was the non-focus group nature of the politics of the episode. Now,
yeah.
not the politics of the episode. It's almost unfair to say that the episode had politics full stop, because there were so many different viewpoints and a lot of things going on within it. But what was striking about it, and I thought this was really strongly expressed in Justin's piece as well, is that this idea, because the idea of the guy passing for white, we should talk about that.
Yes.
Who doesn't love IPAs and chatting, was so, so funny and so raw in a way, in a very, you know, it worked on a number of levels. I think Alan Sepinwall said it was like a Lost Chappelle Show sketch, and I would agree with that. But then the juxtaposition of that joke with the idea of people being transphobic, which is also a serious thing.
Right.
And what I was most struck by, and Justin expressed this in his piece, was that in a way what we were seeing was Paperboy's confusion and frustration with this world. Like mm-hmm. when he says he doesn't have an opinion on Caitlyn Jenner, he's like, I just found out about that.
Right, yeah.
And I think it's pretty remarkable for a show. We talk a lot about how shows have become more personal, more auteur-driven. But for a show to really feel like there was someone expressing a thought, and that thought wasn't sanded down or group tested or run by the network notes or whatever. This was somebody's thought, and it was expressed on a television show. Television, for all of its advantages, isn't usually something that can express a singular point of view like that.
The thing I found really interesting about that is Paperboy's opinion was a lot of black people's opinion about Caitlyn Jenner.
Right.
Who I've heard expressed. I'm not just speaking for like black people in general, but I've heard that, especially mm-hmm. older black people. Actually, Chappelle even does a bit in the stand-up that he's been doing over the last year about that same idea. So when I heard him say it, I was like, this is like kind of like the Chappelle bit I just saw him do, where he talks about his level of participation in the trans community, in the trans world. How much of it is on me? Do I have to accept? Do I have to change mm-hmm. the way I talk to suit your world? And like trying to understand it. And so I could totally see where that might have come up and been like, yes, like we have to do this. And it was counterbalanced well with the woman who was on the panel with him. And then especially when it gets to the point where she starts to agree with him.
Yeah.
yeah, that was the word. It's like, I agree.
How about that line? What's the line in it where he's like, rich white men have been doing crazy shit for a long time? He's like, that doesn't surprise him at all.
But yeah, like it felt authentic. Even in its like how people would see it as murky if they didn't balance it correctly. It was still a real opinion that people have, and then they were able to balance it well with demonstrating, not letting that opinion go unchecked.
Yeah.
Right, right. And how about the fact that this episode, which was filmed who knows how many months ago, and one of the arguments that Montague and Dr. Deborah Holt bring against Paperboy is the glorification of violence in his lyrics, you know?
Right.
And that is such an old argument. And then in the last 2 days, we have surrogates for a major presidential candidate
right.
being like, well, so what if our candidate, you know, aggressively assaults women? other candidates have gone to Beyonce concerts.
Right, where she said, I slay, bitch.
Yeah, right, like, exactly. Like, this is, it's really remarkable when shows, and Mr. Robot did this last year, almost stumble into the zeitgeist or just have never removed themselves from it. I think that's a tough place to be, but
I do think, though, that we often conflate, and rightly so, but we often conflate the opinions of characters on television shows with the opinions of the people who wrote those characters. Right. And I thought that the...
By the way, caveat, on After the Thrones, none of those opinions
were
right.
No, I mean, like,
unfair.
I was just reading off the cards. I wish I was reading off cards. I might have gotten the names right. I think that it's the way that the formal innovation of the show, like to have it in a panel talk and to have Paperboy be a character. Paperboy is not Donald Glover. You know what I mean? Right. They purposely didn't have Earn on that show. Not that Earn would got invited to a panel talk in the first place, but. There is like a distancing technique there, and also it's an artfulness to it that sometimes other shows where it's just like this person is literally the microphone of the creator of the show. You know what I mean? Like it's just coming straight from that person's. It's unadorned with like character work or like story or anything like that or anything that might have affected that opinion in the first place. I thought it was just fascinating to watch.
I also think that for as much as this has become an Atlanta podcast, I also want to make a case that it should be a Brian Tyree Henry podcast because his performance is so magnificent.
Yeah,
and you remember
so
this summer there was a moment when like that Olympian's parents' reaction to her floor routine was like a meme.
Right.
I just want him to react to everything. I want the new like Hitler's Bunker Downfall video to be Paperboy just deadpan stares. You put him in that room against that black background in that purple shirt. His face alone in that episode made it an exceptional episode.
Can you talk to us a little bit about, I mean, we talked about this a couple minutes ago, but just to kind of like round it out, what are some of the rules that it broke? Like, what are some of the rules now that you're like, Donald Glover's been in 30 seconds of this show in the last two episodes.
I mean, that's one right there. Like, the star of the show, quote unquote, has been like absent in like pretty much in two episodes out of six.
Two episodes he wrote and directed, right?
Yes. Yeah. Which maybe is why he's...
Which is smart, but at the same time, doing that is...
And then you get into the rules of, like, you have to choose your world. You either live in the real world or you live in a fantasy world, and you couldn't bridge both. And he's found a way to make the real world and a sort of a fantasy world acceptable to merge and walking a line where there's just enough to keep you not... going, okay, I don't believe the way this world works anymore. Right. I don't know what's possible here. And I think we accept that as viewers because we know his 30 Rock background and we know how Kimmy Schmidt works where there's things that are like, oh, look, there's a dolphin on the sidewalk.
Absurd. It's
heightened,
but it's like, I accept that. And just the notion of, is any idea too crazy if we execute it right?
Right.
Like sometimes you look at the way the show is written and if you had gotten certain notes, it could have ruined the show.
Oh, yeah.
If, like, typical studio notes were like, you can't do that. We're not going to spend 10 minutes roughly
on the show.
There wasn't
even any, like, if they had just done cutaways to Earn off stage at Montague, it would have broken reality of that episode.
Right.
If he was like, what are you saying? Like, you know, it would have broken it. Because then you would have had your audience avatar being like, what's going on?
Right.
And instead, it's just like, no, you have to accept what's happening here.
Right. I mean, to turn in the script with roughly 5 minutes or so of fake commercials, that's not actual show, but it is actual show. Like, how?
Or think about how much time was spent... And the Ahmad commercial with the backgrounds, you know, and the psychic thing, the audio, the way it like fuzzed out when it was like being badly dubbed, like that was sweated over. Like that was a decision. They were like, we are doing something specific here, and we are going to bring the full force of our FX funded production to bear on making a shitty audio cue for a fake pay per view commercial for episode 7 of our sitcom.
Yeah, it's like I'm sure that I will be roasted for saying this, but it kind of reminded me of like Prairie Home Companion in the sense of like the way that you just
You been to any farmers markets
all
recently?
Seriously the whitest thing I've ever said. I just took Atlanta and I was like, let me take this away from black cultural excellence and give it to Garrison Keillor.
You're like, let's bring it back to the prairie, let's bring some fiddle music into it.
What about Keillor though? I just thought it was when you create this side characters, the fact that the Ahmad has come back like a couple of times, the fact that you have this now, this world where this television network exists and where all this stuff is just like, all it does is build towards this show feeling so much more immense than 22 minutes on a Wednesday.
Yeah, and I think it's moving TV forward in a way that we need it. Like, the idea that now your secondary characters can be people,
right,
can take up most of an episode or all of an episode. Well, when you go into a meeting now with an executive or you're pitching a show and you're like, yeah, this is how my show plays out. And also, like, maybe my entire second season now focus mostly on my secondary character, and my primary character in season one becomes secondary to her story because I have this arc for season three where this happens. So I need season two to play out this way.
Yep.
They don't look at you crazy and go, that's not how TV works.
That's going to be amazing when season two of Westworld is just Shannon Woodward's character, like, trying to decide what coffee to get in the morning at Starbucks.
It's not outside the realm of possibility. Yeah. Before we let you go, so Trayvon, before you came to Any Given Wednesday, you were on The Daily Show.
Yes.
The Daily Show is famous because it had Larry Wilmore as the senior black correspondent.
Yes.
I hate to put you in that role on the watch right now, but I'm just curious, as a consumer of TV, as a writer of TV, as a black man sitting in our studio with us as our black correspondent, what do you think of the state of storytelling on TV right now, or the opportunities for more black stories? Because we were talking about, Chris and I were talking about Atlanta, we were talking about Insecure.
Right.
The opportunities for storytelling and for performers seem to be on the upswing, although there's obviously a lot more work to be done.
Right.
What do you, just as a, in the various hats that you wear, what's your take on it?
I'm super excited at the success of both of those shows, Insecure and Atlanta, and my hope is that it now demonstrates the ability to succeed by letting black voices tell black stories the way they want to tell them and not getting in the way of that or not trying to pinpoint or focus group them too much. Like, this has to appeal to everybody. Like, Black-ish, when I found out, was only watched by 24% of black people, I was blown away by that.
Yeah.
Because I felt like...
But that's the audience breakdown?
Yeah, 24% black. I was totally blown away because I felt like, oh, here we have this show that in my eyes was like, for us to see a different version of our lives, and it's watched by mostly white people.
Yeah.
And I was curious to know, why aren't more of us watching it? I don't know the answer to that, but it's still a great show, and I hope that now, like Donald Glover having an all-black writer's room to send a message to people that, like, you can have us in the room, or you can have all of us in the room and still do a great job, that all the undiscovered Issa Rae's and Donald Glover's who have been trying to get their scripts read or trying to get their shows made will have the opportunity to have their voices heard on some platform, be it television or Netflix or Amazon or Hulu. Like, just allow brown people and Asian people and people who don't normally have a seat at the table to tell those stories. And I think Master of None demonstrated that by, like, winning, what, two Emmys in their first season and a Peabody Award. Like, my hope is that this is not a fad or a trend where they're like, remember the late 2010s when, like, there was like all those hot black shows, and then we went away from them kind of in the 90s when you had all those black shows, and then we had that long period where there were like none on TV. I hope this is the beginning of expanding the voices on TV in a more permanent way.
Because what's amazing to me about Atlanta is that it is absolutely, without question, the most diverse show on television in its storytelling.
Right.
Purely the style of storytelling, even within that one episode.
True.
That is separate and apart from the fact that it has an all-black writer's room.
Right.
And, you know, we're all recording in a town on a lot where, like, one of the biggest rules is this: there's a diversity hire, quote-unquote,
sure,
right, for every network show,
right,
which was a project launched with good intentions, certainly, and it has brought more diversity into the rooms, but even anecdotally, I know of cases where it's a check, it's a box to be checked.
Sure.
There's a diversity hire in the room.
You don't necessarily have a voice. You're just in the room.
And you're in the room, and you are also just one voice. And
right,
the idea is, you look at a room like Atlanta, which is an all-black writer's room, think of the diversity of voices within that room,
sure,
which is a level of diversity that I think even a well-intentioned industry has been ignorant of for too long.
Yeah, totally agree.
If we can hang on long enough, maybe we'll get a chance to write token white characters.
I can't listen. It's been too long since...
Andy, what would a white person say here?
Listen, Chris, all I want to say is, as a Jewish male in his late 30s, I have been denied a voice in the entertainment industry for too long. I've got a lot to say about crisp Chablis and how they should pair with Thai food.
Trayvon, thanks for joining us this
week,
man.
Thanks,
hopefully we have you on again. We'll have you on again to talk more about Atlanta maybe towards the end of the season.
I love it. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, guys.
All right, man.
Guys, I just want to take a quick break to talk to you about Sonos. Listen, Chris and I are fully on board Team Sonos. This is a pretty great product. So Sonos is a smart speaker system. It streams all your favorite music to any room or every room. You can control your music with one simple app, and you can do it with pure immersive sound. So Chris and I are new to the Sonos train.
Yeah.
We have speakers in a bunch of different rooms in our homes, separate homes, I should note. But I have to tell you, this thing is really, really cool. It is so easy. You can put your Spotify, your Apple Music, your personal music.
You can listen to the radio from all over the country. It's incredible.
I just moved from New York City. I put a Sonos speaker in my kitchen, and now I can listen to NPR like I used to back at home in the same way that I did at home.
Or Hot 97, or Philly Sports Talk Radio. It's great.
And here's the other thing. It is an incredibly simple, simple product. There's one button on each speaker. If you want to hook it up through different phones, maybe you live with someone who wants to use the set system, it's really that easy. And there's one simple addition that I want to mention.
Tell me about it.
There is a play pause button on the speaker, because let me tell you, I have used other streaming services before that have tried to bring my digital music into the real world.
Yeah.
And if I ever want to pause it or change songs, you got to grab the phone, you got to pull up everything, you got to mess around, you got to make sure you're on the Wi-Fi.
Don't do that.
Guess what you do with Sonos?
Just hit pause on the speaker.
Just hit pause.
It's so incredible.
It's so much easier. I really, really actually recommend Sonos. Anyway, so it's a speaker system you can listen to in any room or every room all at once. Play a different song in your living room, your bedroom, your bathroom. You can do it in your garage. Whatever you want to do. Add to your existing music services or discover something new, or be like me and Chris and just listen to NPR and think.
Sonos! All right, man, we're back. Andy, let's talk a little bit about the final Rogue One trailer, which is, it sounds like there is not much to talk about there, but this is something we've been talking about. The development and the marketing of Rogue One is something we've been talking about.
Are we sure this is the final? Did they say that?
I believe so. I mean, maybe there'll be more, but I can't imagine. That's a good question. I can't imagine they can show us much more without it being sort of ruined.
If they're still filming it and changing it, they could. Yeah. I think a couple things about this.
So just to catch people up, Gareth Edwards, director of Godzilla and Monsters, hired to do this. It was initially sort of pitched out to the world as a Star Wars war film.
It's a standalone film.
It's a prequel, or it's a standalone film set in the time before A New Hope. The stealing of the plans for the Death Star. And it was sort of supposed to be dark Star Wars, right? And it was supposed to be a realistic, quote-unquote, war movie.
It also came from what I believe was a time when Disney bought Lucasfilm, and they were like, we're gonna fire up the main story machine, but we're also going to keep this IP cooking, and we're going to make a lot of stories in this world, and we're going to create this banner where we can allow filmmakers to express different styles and different voices.
And to their credit, it is this, like, the Star Wars movies are and probably will continue to be, we'll figure out in the next one, the continuing story of the Skywalker family. It's the Skywalker saga, basically.
And the Jedis and, like,
But each Star Wars movie needs to have a Skywalker in it. It's like the kind of, and then these sort of standalone films can either be historical, quote unquote, within the realm. So there'll be a Han Solo spinoff, and there's this, and there's Rogue One. So Rogue One first trailer comes out, looks really cool. We got very excited about it.
All the trailers have been as good as trailers get, I have to say.
Yes, I think that they have gotten increasingly more like middle of the road.
Well, this is the thing.
As middle of the road as something can be with a fucking Star Destroyer in it.
Well, this is the thing I wanted to say about it, because this trailer, again, I think just in terms of pure construction of a trailer is masterful. This is the first glimpse we've seen of the movie since you know, we were all a little surprised because the first trailer looked so good, and then there were all these reports of how they were going back
and then
for
there was,
massive.
But then there was another trailer that was a little bit more like,
well, Darth Vader was in it.
Darth is in it, yeah.
But there were these massive reshoots. There were what we heard were an attempt to make it lighter in some ways, brighten it, basically what it sounded like was to bring it more in line with the Star Wars brand.
And Tony Gilroy had reportedly been brought in to both rewrite parts of the script and oversee some of the reshoots.
Which confuses me so much.
Nobody has, it's not really been officially confirmed or denied.
The thing about it, the vibe I get from this, and it's you know, one day maybe someone will be able to write these books or write these articles about the behind-the-scenes machinations of major conglomerates with their hottest IPs. Like, you know, Marvel is also a Disney property, and I think the making and marketing of those movies is fascinating, but they're completely sealed. They don't let any light in to find out how it's actually mm-hmm. done. Similarly with Star Wars, but it does seem to me that they had this very exciting idea to make it, to open up the gates and make it more creative. And then they realized at some point, holy shit, we're making a Star Wars movie. And when Force Awakens came out and made $1 billion, this movie isn't going to make $1 billion, but there's a little bit of an assumption that it should come close.
Yeah,
and
they have the reverse problem of what DC does. DC keeps having films which, while they make $600, $500, $700 million, are perceived by certain circles as failures.
Right.
So, in a way, DC can only get better, right?
Yes.
Disney is Star Wars, both with Marvel and with these Star Wars films. They really can't, like, they can only go down. You know what I mean? Like, even if you didn't think Force Awakens was a film on the level of Star Wars right. or Empire.
It ticked every box.
It ticked every box. It was a huge success, and most people came out of it being satisfied.
Yeah, which is really, which is what the goal is in blockbuster management.
Right.
You want to satisfy the largest quadrant of people you possibly can. Which is not the goal in necessarily in a focused war movie.
Yes, and I would also say that they slice the sort of potential audience a little bit, because the kind of person who's interested in this movie is pretty much people, I think, like us, who grew up with Star Wars and had the sort of historical relationship to what may have happened before the first Star Wars film. You know, like, I just think that if you're a 7 or 8 year old or a 10 year old,
and you're listening to this podcast,
yeah, and you're just like I prefer the Andy Greenwald show, but this is fine.
Yeah.
if you're a 10 year old, like, do you know about what were the plans to destroy the Death Star? Maybe you do. I mean, well, I knew a lot about Star Wars when I was a kid.
I think that this is incredibly rich territory. I mean, it's really cool, honestly. Just
yeah,
purely
yeah.
in a kid like level, like, they kind of, if you think about the original Star Wars trilogy, they do yada yada some of the more interesting things, one of which being, why is there a rebellion, who is the rebellion, and how the fuck did they build a giant robot machine that can destroy planets?
Can I,
like,
tell you
that's
something
enormous.
George Lucas then made 3 movies about that.
No, he made 3 movies about Muppets and tax collecting.
I know, but that's a lot of yada yada.
That was a lot of yada yada. Good point. But so my takeaway from this trailer, because we're talking about it a lot, is that it was, you know, I think the cast is still terrific. I think it looks amazing.
Yes.
But my main takeaway from this was that it had been run through the Hollywood machine. Like, the
yes.
the effect of, like, the Robert McKee screenwriting stuff, the Save the Cat, was so all over this. Because the thing is, a cool, pared-down war movie, even with a $100 million budget, it doesn't matter who these rebels, these rogues, if you will, are. They have a mission, and they're going to get the mission. And, like, that's what was really appealing about the movie for me on paper, and even in those first trailers. Now, someone's got daddy issues.
They've definitely softened the edges. Yeah.
Someone has a personal connection to
sure.
the story, which is absolutely the first note.
And rather than being a punk, like in the punk rock sense,
yes.
like in the, like, I rebel, which
that,
was the tagline of, like, her sort of tagline when they were like, oh, can you handle this? And she was like,
this is a rebellion.
I thought this was rebellion. I rebel. Like, that it was
first
that
of all,
was
that
her
was,
vibe.
That was a dope
and
line.
That was dope. This time, she says rebellions are about hope. We can do it. It's all affirmative. It's all, like, inclusive. It's like, I'm part of a team. Which was not what the message of the first trailer was. So if you're looking for what they might have done to this movie in between, that's it.
That's it right there.
Yes.
And what's interesting about this is we are watching this shift in real time, like, being affected by creative notes, by executive
yes.
notes, and by market forces. And often,
nobody has seen the movie yet.
No one's seen
like
the movie
Bob
yet.
Iger has seen this movie. That's it.
One of the things that we often talk about, why what separates television and movies, is how responsive television is. Because, you know, over the course of a season or the course of multiple seasons, you get feedback on the product and you can write towards the feedback. You can change your show based on what's working, what's not working, because it's ongoing.
Yeah.
You have another shot at it, or you get the feedback directly from people having seen part of it. To say that movies aren't that, the movies exist in this sort of, you know, intense perfection chamber until they are released, finished on the world, is a very antiquated point of view. Because really, these are all one movie now. Or, to be fair, this is now the Star Wars television show, of which there are going to be installments yearly.
Sure.
And so we are seeing them change this in real time.
Well, you touched on something I do want to get into in a more general sense, which is like the idea of like that nothing convincing can happen in a movie without daddy issues, without like it being part of some sort of I must fix some familial error in the past, or you know, atone for, or satisfy, or affirm some sort of
the hole that's been ripped in the world has been ripped in me first. It's, yes. It has to be the personal and global,
right? And this is I don't have the exact quote, but I can just relay this. It was like, so recently Kenneth Lonergan was giving a talk at like a screenwriting conference in London.
Remind people who this who
Kenneth
the
Lonergan
God
is. The writer of Margaret, You Can Count on Me, and the upcoming Manchester by the Sea, writer and director. And but he's a very good screenwriter and obviously
and playwright.
And he was talking about the Narnia movies, like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and some of the other ones. And he was talking about how much he hated them, honestly.
Yeah, it was cool to see someone actually use words like that.
Yeah, and his point was basically, like, they've added all this stuff where, you know, like, two characters will be, like, child characters, like, going down the river on a glacier or, like, an ice floe or something.
To be clear, I've never seen these movies.
I've actually never read them. And one picks up a sword because it's, like, there's an attack coming, and his sister turns to him and says, you know, to pick up that sword is to have great responsibility, and, like, basically emotionalizes what is a purely action moment.
Uh-huh.
And kind of degrades the best parts of what we consider, say, genre. You know, and I think that that's the thing that we've talked about a lot. Like, whenever somebody in a genre show turns to another character and is like, am I a bad man? It's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
No one does that.
No one does it.
You might think it in the darkest part of the night or in the early part of the morning when you're thinking about what you did the next day, but nobody turns to somebody else and says, am I a bad man?
No.
And it's like, that's a note. That's a, we need the audience to know that this person is weighing the moral scales inside of them.
Yes, because we do not trust either the audience to pick up on it, or the actors, or the writers, or the creative storytellers to be able to communicate it.
We need that to send it, literally need it for marketing, to be like, this is a story that grapples with these questions.
We need to put that line in the trailer. We can need to be able to translate it into 19 languages so it plays internationally.
So the idea that this, obviously science fictional, war would be happening, a civil war between an empire and a rebellion, and that people would need the motivation of,
yes,
you know, some sort of like father issue to join in on a fight. Now, of course, there is no bigger daddy issue than Darth Vader.
But right?
You don't know that for a lot of the movie.
Yes, and Darth Vader has been shoehorned into this movie.
Yeah.
So the biggest daddy issue of all is still there.
It's still looming.
And I think, you know, I'm impressed that we're getting this much traction out of a trailer, but I think it's a conversation.
We're talking about storytelling, though.
But
yeah,
it's a conversation worth having, because the one thing that would be poisonous, I think, to a franchise that has global designs that mm-hmm. needs to make X amount of money in every part of the world would be any actual politics. And what I mean by that isn't like, you know, we need Ben Mendelsohn to want to make Endor great again. What I mean by that is exactly what you said.
Ewoks for Mendelsohn.
If there is a fascist empire crushing the hopes and dreams of small people on desert planets everywhere, if slavery exists, which by the way it does in the Star Wars universe, you don't need to be sad about your dad to join up.
Exactly. When I watched the first two Star Wars movies, it was really amazing when they revealed that Darth was Luke's father. Spoiler.
Oh my God. All the 7 and 8 year olds who listen to our podcast. Also, Tooth Fairy, not real.
But that wasn't why I liked Star Wars. People go back and they're like, oh yeah, you have to have, like, no.
It actually,
I like Star Wars because I just felt completely transported by this Joseph Campbell story.
It led with the adventure and then twisted the knife of the emotional thing. So the second layer was the emotion.
Right. And here's the problem. Nobody knows who Mads Mikkelsen is.
Well, he's Hannibal.
Yeah, but you can't base the movie off of like this emotional relationship
that nobody has an
investment in yet. So it's like, if you're saying she is joining the rebellion because Mads Mikkelsen was taken away by the Empire at some point, which is clearly broadcast in the trailer.
Yeah.
Fine, but who cares? We're going to spend, 20 minutes with them as, like, a family unit? And it's like all of a sudden, it's not the Corleone family. It's not like you're going to spend 4 hours with them.
Also, isn't there an element of as the father of daughters and the son of a mother and the colleague of secretaries, I'm offended.
Right.
Because one of the coolest things about...
As an amateur pilot, I loved The English Patient. You know, it's like, what?
But one of the cool things about Rogue One, as it appeared to be from the first trailers, was that Felicity, can I call her Felicity? Are we just pals? Her character, this Jyn Erso character, just seemed to be, as you said, she was a badass. She was the person they needed to make this happen, and her reasons for doing so were her own. It wasn't just because she had daddy issues. That wasn't, you know, she could be a hero separate and apart from that, which I think is a cool thing. You know, and one of the cool things about A Force Awakens was that Rey was swept up in things. And we, and you know, because Force Awakens is essentially a Xerox of A New Hope, the emotional connection is TBD.
Well, yeah,
it's still looming. Yes. We don't know whose daughter she is, but she's going to be somebody's daughter.
Hope somebody over there knows whose daughter she is.
Hope they've decided on that by now in the massive rewrite sessions they've got going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's weird. It's not... This is one of those examples where I started to say it's weird to me that they did this, but it's actually the exact opposite. This makes total sense. This is... It now feels like a much more stable product. And it still could be quite effective and quite sweeping, quite well done. I mean, we're not saying up or down on the movie because, to be clear, we are not Bob Iger and we have not seen it. But what it says about fitting stories into the machine in 2016 was a little disheartening.
Yeah, we can't leave the streets alone without talking about the Strokes.
Because this is 2016.
The band of the streets. So we talked about this a little bit on Monday because at some point this week, maybe it was Monday, it was the 15th anniversary of the first Strokes album, Is This It, right?
Yeah.
And I guess I thought it was vaguely controversial.
You're a bomb thrower.
It's not a bomb thrower. I just think it's just my opinion. It's like, I'm not like trying to denigrate Is This It. I
Christopher
just
Slate.com Ryan is at it again.
I think Room on Fire is better than Is This It. And I was met with some resistance in my personal life from that. Amanda Dobbins, hi. And
Amanda's not over it. I saw Amanda this morning, and she is real sore at you.
But Amanda's point was really well taken. First of all, she just thinks the songs are better, I think. You know, and she
on
thinks,
Is This It.
And the highs of Is This It are definitely higher than Room
this
on Fire.
This is all true.
But it's also like, let me have this. Like, that was a very important moment. It was like, that was like, it's like anytime somebody goes back and tries to rewrite sort of your personal musical history, it's annoying. But I did take it to Twitter because I believe in democracy, believe it or not. And
Twitter snap polls are absolutely
so
the most effective representation.
So here's the interesting thing. The numbers, Nate Silver, say Is This It is the resounding favorite. Uh-huh. Okay? 65-35. Mm. But the personal feedback I got from the people.
Wow.
The anecdotal feedback.
You mean the size at your rallies?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Where have I heard that before?
Was very much like, you've really made me think.
Well, that's always been your goal. As a person, as a pundit, as a podcaster. You just want to make, like CNC Music Factory, you just want to make people go...
All these 7-year-olds are out here being like, I have no horse in this race.
They're like, the only Strokes album we see is Angles. That's the only truth we recognize. Here was my take on this. I reacted with Dobbins-esque shock when you declared the second Strokes record to be better than the first.
Yeah.
I've done a little research, which means I went back and listened to both albums, something I've not done in a while.
Yeah.
And I was really struck by the fact that Room on Fire is pretty good. But... I think there are a number of arguments here going on. One is that I think it is very, very hard to argue credibly that, for example, the songs on Room on Fire are taken together better, or that the highs are better, or that it is as consistent an album as Is This It. I think the thing about Is This It, at the time, I mean, it's very close to a perfect album. It has aged very well, and it stands up as an exemplar of an entire time in people's lives and in time in musical history.
We all bought leather jackets.
Did you ever have a leather jacket?
Yeah, I think so. At least I had a jean jacket that I felt very strongly
about. You did have a great jean jacket. You may have even had a pin on it, one or two. It was the early 2000s. We were young. But to revisit Room on Fire, it was much better than I remember it being. But I wonder how much of that was hindsight. Because when I was listening to it now and I was realizing like whatever happened, and certainly Reptilia and
Automatic Stop, 1251.
Meet Me in the Bathroom.
Yep, see?
These are great songs.
Yeah?
These are really great songs. Uh-huh. But in retrospect, I am much chiller about the whole thing. I'm not wearing a jean jacket.
Great.
And I think that when Is This It came out, there was an assumption and a need, because we worked in music magazines at the time, that these guys were the next greatest band and that they were going to be Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, and like they would make many, many albums that would be on bar jukeboxes forever, because
we assumed we'd be going to bars and that we'd be going to jukeboxes. If anything, I was shocked that they came out with Room on Fire.
But the thing for me, the thing to remember is that I think they were always telling us who they were, which is like really, really high 20-year-old drunks. But in addition to that, do you remember in the, is it the Someday video where they're playing Family Feud with Guided by Voices?
Uh-huh.
In that era, Julian Casablancas just wanted to be Guided by Voices. And if you look at it through that prism,
you know who Julian Casablancas really wanted to be?
Tell me.
Julian Casablancas.
Wow.
That guy had a pretty cool life for him.
He did. But what I mean is, it's understandable that the type of songwriting they were doing
wasn't
sustainable.
He wasn't like, I really want to be like a late 40s, early 50s ex-public school teacher who lives in Dayton and makes 9 albums a year that some people listen to.
But he wanted to drink like one. It just seemed like when you listen to these records in retrospect, and in many ways this is something we touched on with when we had Will Sheff on last week too, it's like free of context, I could just hear it as a really strong record. But records, what makes records great is more than the sum of their parts. It is the context. You know, that is an enormous part of it. So I understand why Amanda and I felt this way, and others probably did too, that it feels really hot takey to say it. But in the same way that like our personal favorites aren't mm-hmm. always the best. So let's take another band that we like. Like if you look at Fleetwood Mac, which I'm always doing.
Okay.
Rumors, there's an argument to be made it's the most popular album of all time, certainly one of the most popular albums of all time. Tusk is my favorite album of all time. But
Tusk is your favorite album of all time,
yes.
Of all music.
Yes. But
damn.
But I don't want to get into an argument, even though I've just brought it up. But the thing is,
if you said it's my favorite, I'm not going to get into an argument.
But that's what I mean. I don't think it's necessarily better than Rumors, because it was a very different project.
Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah.
Is it between Tusk and Rumors?
It's the only two albums that are good?
Yeah.
Well, Mirage is pretty good.
All of music.
Tango in the Night has some moments, too. And I have a version of Say You Will, where I cut it down to like 12, 13 tracks, and it's right up there with them. Did I just hijack this?
I have a version.
I do. I have a hot Say You Will edit. I'll throw that on Spotify.
No, but you're not like Larry Levan. You weren't making like garage edits of it. It's just like you just skip songs,
I have a chopped and screwed version of Fleetwood Mac's album Say You Will.
Went back in and just remastered it a little. You didn't think Bob Clearmountain got it the first time?
He just missed it. Richard Dashett he had his finger on the pulse.
Yeah.
Listen, the other thing about Room on Fire... Am I just talking a lot to hide the fact that you're a little bit right? Let me just say that.
I know that, like, if you take out all the cultural stuff around it and the momentum that it had for the thirst and excitement that was surrounding the first record, Room on Fire has just better songs.
I don't know if they're better, but I think that they are interesting and complicated because it is an example of something. And actually, here I did it. I did it. Much like Rumors and Tusk, an enormous album that is a great, you know, that is a great celebratory album for a lot of people, and the Hangover album. And the relationship between the albums is almost as interesting as the albums themselves.
I Don't Want to Be Forgotten, man. It's the first line of the record.
It's the first line. And the last line is, I'll be right back. Spoiler alert, he wasn't right back. when they came back, they kind of weren't that band anymore. But the relationship between success and fame and that moment when songwriters are at the top of their game and then when they have to do it again is perpetually interesting.
Cool. Yeah, it's interesting.
And so here's what I'm saying. We shouldn't pit these albums against each other.
No, I know. Art deserves to just live out in the meadow. Why would we do a podcast then?
Who's Art? Art Shell?
Yeah, that's right.
Just let Art Shell in a meadow.
That's what this pod is about. We will be back Monday. We will be talking Westworld. We will talk a little bit about Halt and Catch Fire.
I hope so. Check out my podcast for the Show Runners.
Maybe I will continue to make my case for divorce. The show.
Good, because I know our wives, neither of them listen to this podcast, but odds would be that this is the one that they do.
All right, talk to you later, man.
Good job, Ritzky.
Thanks again to Falling Water, the new USA Network show, for sponsoring The Watch today. We think that we each dream our own dreams, right? But what if someone could use your dreams against you without you ever knowing? On October 13th, producers of The Walking Dead and Homeland present Falling Water, a new original drama on the USA Network where the battle for your dreams is real and happens while you sleep. Starring David Ajala and Will Yun Lee, Falling Water is a new original series. It airs Thursday, October 13th at 10, 9 Central, only on USA Network.
Thanks again to Sonos for sponsoring us today. Remember, Sonos is the smart speaker system. It streams all your favorite music to any room, every room, one room, two room, five rooms. I don't know what kind of a mansion you guys live in, but it's very handy wherever you live. It all takes is a simple app for your phone, for your tablet. It brings together all your favorite music services, lets you control everything from songs to volumes to rooms to your preferred NPR stations. Play a different song in the living room, whatever room you got. Add to your existing music services. Discover something new. I am on the Sonos train. Jump on board.
Sonos.